Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 77 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Julia Kopis is joined by fellow poets Debjani Chatterjee, Basir Kazmi and Mimi Kalvati to explore the long history and contemporary pleasures of the ghazal, a traditional poetic form that's become increasingly popular in the West.
Writing about the virtues of fame versus obscurity, the 18th century Indian poet Mirza Ghalib declared, in a rough translation, "A few of the dead have bloomed as tulip or rose, but how many others lie under the dust beside those?" The form in which Ghalib was writing had begun its life some 1,200 years earlier, in the Arabic verse of the 6th century. But the ghazal is often viewed as a Persian form, made famous by the legendary poets Hafiz and Rumi. Primarily composed for performance rather than for the page, ghazals are traditionally delivered at large gatherings called mushaira. The central theme of the ghazal is love, and especially illicit or unattainable love. Joining me to unravel the mysteries of the ghazal are poets Debjani Chatterjee, Basir Kazmi, and Mimi Kalvati. Debjani, I wonder if you could start by talking us through the roots of the ghazal in Arabic literature. We're going back to medieval times here, aren't we, and to a longer poetic form called the qasida. What is a qasida and where does the ghazal fit in?
The qasida was actually originally an Arabic, a long Arabic poem, which dates back from pre-Islamic times. So the qasida had many sections to it. It's always been the case that in the qasida, there was this very distinctive section which was autonomous. And I think almost from the beginning, that autonomous section, which is the ghazal, it was found could really stand on its own. It could be taken out of the qasida. The Persians loved the ghazal. Persian writers took to the ghazal so much so that they made it the preeminent form of poetry in their language.
So the ghazal has its roots then in Arabic literature and then moved on to be adopted or adapted by Persian poetry and later became an important part of the Urdu poetic tradition, which Basir is a part of. Mimi, you were born in Persia, or Iran, as it now is, but you've lived for most of your life in England, and I know you've written a number of ghazals in English. And at the moment, probably your best-known ghazal is the poem called simply Ghazal, because it's currently on a GCSE syllabus. Could you talk us through the basic form of the ghazal, especially in terms of structure and rhyme scheme? And then perhaps you would demonstrate it by reading that particular poem for us.
Well, it is primarily a love lyric. And the form is always in couplets, two-line verses. And we have many English forms, or poems that are written in couplets, but in this case, these are discrete couplets. That is to say, the meaning or the sense ends at the end of each second line. So they're discrete units, commonly thought of as pearls on a string. So an audience listening to a ghazal might remember one couplet, memorize it, take it home with them. In addition to the closed couplets, there is a rhyme that is set up in the first couplet twice and then subsequently comes in at the end of the second line of each couplet. Sometimes there's also a refrain. In Farsi, we would call it the radif, which is a small word or phrase that always follows the rhyme. So the rhyme and refrain always go together. And the last thing is that very often, either in the last or penultimate couplet, which is quite often known as the signature couplet, the author mentions herself or himself by name or pseudonym.
As you have done in this ghazal.
I have done with a play on my name, Mimi, yes.
Okay, so we'll listen out for that play on your name, and it occurs in the penultimate line in your poem here.
Yes, it does.
Will you read it for us?
Yes. Ghazal. If I am the grass and you the breeze, blow through me. If I am the rose and you the bird, then woo me. If you are the rhyme and I the refrain, don't hang on my lips. Come, and I'll come too when you cue me. If yours is the iron fist and the velvet glove, when the arrow flies, the heart is pierced, tattoo me. If mine is the venomous tongue, the serpent's tail, charmer, use your charm, weave a spell and subdue me. If I'm the laurel leaf in your crown, you are the arms around my bark, arms that never knew me. Oh, would that I were bark, so old and still in leaf, and you dropping in my shade, dew to bedew me. What shape should I take to marry your own? Have you hawk to my shadow, moth to my flame, pursue me? If I rise in the east as you die in the west, die for my sake, my love, every night renew me. If, when it ends, we are just good friends, be my friend, muse, lover and guide, Shams-ed-Din to my Rumi. Be heaven and earth to me, and I'll be twice the me I am, if only half the world you are to me.
Wonderful. Twice the me I am, Mimi. Very good. And that poem, of course, fits in with a traditional theme of love and the poet as ardent lover. Basir, your father, Nasir Kazmi, was a celebrated Urdu poet and a gifted composer of ghazals in Urdu, as indeed are you. I understand that he enjoyed huge adulation, though, of the sort that's reserved in the West for pop stars.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's right. He was and still is a very popular poet, and his books are bought by hundreds of poetry lovers, and his ghazals are available on YouTube, sung by famous singers.
So that analogy with Western pop stars is not a lame one, because actually the ghazal is sung.
It's in Mushairas, which is a gathering of poets attended by sometimes, you have to believe, 20,000-25,000 people.
Wow.
On occasion, normally up to 1,000. And it's a sort of music concert without music. But ghazal is, again, the most popular form of poetry in Mushairas.
So when you say it's a music concert without the music,
I mean that the atmosphere we have at a music concert,
mm-hmm,
can be seen at certain musharas, hundreds of people, thousands of people, and there's a stage, microphone, and
that includes a certain amount of audience participation as the ghazal is being recited.
Exactly. I mean, and the audience, they can ask the poet to recite a couplet again and again and again. And sometimes they tease the poet and the poet doesn't realize whether it's a praise or a sort of hooting.
Devjani, ghazals are not just for the literary minded, though, are they? And there are other places, I think, like the cinema, for instance, where ghazals might be heard.
The ghazal was always, and is still, a form of poetry that is very much for everyone. I think that was uppermost in the mind of ghazal composers. And so it's certainly quite popular in Bollywood movies, for instance. And apart from movies, of course, the theatre.
I mean, besides movies and the singers singing ghazals for movies, they sing ghazals at their concerts and also on TV and radio.
I'd like to talk about some of the great proponents of the ghazal historically. Mimi, you mentioned Rumi in the poem that you read for us. I've got his dates here as 1207 to 73. And today, Rumi is credited with being the best-selling poet in the USA. Hafez was roughly a century later, I think, and again a hugely influential figure. I've read that most people in Iran learn his poems by heart and use them as proverbs and sayings. Could you tell us a little bit, Mimi, about these great Persian poets, Rumi and Hafez?
The phenomenon of Rumi topping the bestseller charts, not only of poetry, but in general, you know, fiction, everything, is quite extraordinary. I think this has happened largely through the translations of Coleman Barthes and the whole New Age thing. I don't think those translations, well, certainly formally, they don't reflect the originals. I haven't read Rumi in the original, but what I'm very much aware of, Rumi was the great mystical poet of Persia. And in Hafez, I think the secular stream of poetry through Saadi, the mystical through Rumi came together. And Hafez is best loved as the ultimate lyrical love poet par excellence and the poet of the Ghazal. People can quote him by heart, and he is used as a sort of fortune-telling. You know, everyone has a copy of Hafez, like, say, here, hotels might have the Bible, you know, somewhere. And if they want to set the date for a wedding, they will consult Hafez to see what date might be auspicious or not.
And that's an interesting thing that you have pointed towards. Hafez's collection of ghazals is also used as the oracle of Delphi, I would say. So it has got that status. It's called Fal. So people would, if they are stuck and they are just not able to decide between 2, 3, 4 options, so they would have some clues and then close their eyes and open Hafez's collection. And then the couplet that appears in front of them would give them, or they think it's giving them a clue to find some solution or a way out.
That is similar to the way that the Bible is sometimes used in this country, for example. And Devjani, can you say anything more about the historic presence of
Yes, Hafez, indeed. During the 200 years of British presence in India, there was a great discovery going on the part of the West, a discovery of literature, the religions, the mythologies, etc., of the East. And at this time, some extremely loose translations were being produced. But those translations spread like wildfire and became very, very popular. There was a kind of love affair that went on at that period, and therefore there were English poets who were also trying to write in that vein. One of the reasons why this became so popular, I think, was the fact that poets like Rumi, Hafez, Umar Khayyam were great Sufi poets. And Sufi Islam, I think, in the West, owes its popularity to that era, and it has never really lost that popularity.
So just to recap, we have Rumi in the 13th century, followed by Hafez in the 14th. I'd like us to talk a bit now about the Urdu tradition. So, jumping forward a few hundred years to the 18th century, could someone tell us about Mirza Ghalib, whom I quoted in the introduction? He was living and writing during the time of the British colonial rule in India that, Devjani, you were talking about. I wonder, Basir, if you could say a little bit about Ghalib.
Ghalib is considered to be one of the 2-3 greatest poets of Urdu. But one thing is, without any dispute, that he is the most popular. A critic, Abdul Rahman Bajnori, has said something very interesting about Ghalib, and it has become very famous and controversial as well. But people have accepted it. That he said that India has 2 holy books. One is Vedas, the other Diwan-e-Ghalib, the collection of Ghalib, which is a big comment. And everybody, even those who don't agree with it, they see an element of truth in it.
So let's see why the comment was.
Yeah, I mean, so because he's so popular, people, almost everybody, illiterate people, they remember something of Ghalib, some couplet, part of movies, concerts, in books, in textbooks, everywhere.
And he wrote in both Persian and Urdu.
He is one of those. I mean, Ghalib is equally great in his Persian poetry as well as Urdu. And in fact, he was more proud of his Persian poetry, but his Urdu poetry became more popular because it was a new thing. Because in Persian, we already had Hafiz, Sadi, Rumi, and others.
So, are there certain salient features that distinguish Ghalib from other writers that make him stand out in such a stark way?
His poetry appeals to intellect, and he also expanded the scope of Urdu poetry. His topics are diverse, and almost anything from life could feature. Ghalib took account of the political, social situation and the day-to-day realities of life, problems, difficulties.
So we'll jump forward again, 3 centuries this time, to the present day. And here are the 3 of you, still writing ghazals, but quite differently, I think, from each other. Basir has written predominantly in Urdu. Mimi, you've written in English. And Debjani, you've done a lot of translation and written in English. Can you just say a little bit about the translation work?
I've translated ghazals from Bengali, which is my mother tongue, and also from Hindi and Urdu. It's a form that I am fascinated with. It is a very demanding form. Especially in English, I have to say, because there are some things which come easier in certain languages. What happens is that in translation, it becomes extremely difficult to retain all the different features of the ghazal. Am I going to perhaps sacrifice meaning in order to retain, say, the rhyming scheme, the meter, the radif? Or am I going to keep true to the meaning and sacrifice some of those features? So it's been a compromise. But I've also always tried to keep the signature couplet aspect.
Yes.
Because that is something, again, which is distinctive of the ghazal. And I find that a very beautiful form, which is so alien to English poetry.
I think the difficulties you're talking about in translation, they probably apply particularly to a strict form like the ghazal, although there are also universal problems as well, I think, of compromises of one kind.
And rhyming is something, I should say, that comes so easily to certain languages,
yes,
like Urdu, for instance, and also Bengali. Yeah. It's almost, it has been said, a little tongue-in-cheek, that it is easier to write a rhyming poem in those languages than to actually
write in verse. Because the rhymes are so abundant.
Yes, but in English that's not the case. And in English one has to make a lot of, I think, compromises.
So we've talked about your translation work. Let's talk now about your writing of ghazals in English as an original language. Your ghazal, An Indian Summer, where the refrain, roaring rivers or sometimes roaring waters, runs through the poem. And that, I think, is the radif. And what I like about this poem, your Indian Summer, is the way that the poem mixes two very different cultures and locations through this idea of river worship. So in the poem, you're walking along the flat towpath of a canal in Sheffield, where you live now. But your mind is in India, in the peaks of the Himalayas. Would you read that poem for us? Perhaps you'd first explain Mandakini.
I should also say that although, yes, I would call it a ghazal, but really more a ghazal adaptation. Mandakini is the name of the river Ganges when she flows through heaven. An Indian summer. September. And I see the urban fisher folk dreaming of salmon leaping in roaring rivers. Sunday in Sheffield, and I walk by the canal. The high Himalayas drum with roaring rivers. The dragonfly flits in the Yorkshire afternoon while Mandakini descends in roaring waters. Once a laughing goddess roamed along these banks. Now unknown, her name resounds through roaring waters. Ducks swim, ruffling their feathers over this landscape. Yards away, industry storms its roaring waters. Whatever she is called, Ganga meditates on summer, rippling the calm of English rivers.
Thank you, Devjani. So, Bastia, a ghazal of yours, The True Hearted, Devjani has translated with you into English. Well, I wonder if you would read it for us in the original first, in the Urdu, and then in translation.
Now, ghazals in Urdu and Persian don't have any title, but the translation, the English translation that I'll recite afterwards, does have a title. Dil lada lete hain ahle dil, vatan koi bhi ho. Phool ko khilne se matlab hai, chaman koi bhi ho. Surate halat hi par baat karni hai agar, phir mukhatab ho koi bhi, anjuman koi bhi ho. Hai wohi la hasili, दस्ते हुनर की मुंतजिर आखिरश सर फोड़ता है कोह कन कोई भी हो हैं जो पुरज आरजू होते नहीं मुहताज मैं रात दिन मखमूर रखती है लगन कोई भी हो है किसी महबूब की मानिंद उसका इंतजार दीदा दिल फर्श राह मुश्ताक फन कोई भी हो शायरी में आज भी मिलता है नासिर का निशान ढूंढते हैं हम उसे बज़्म सुखन कोई भी हो आदतें और हाजतें बासिर बदलती हैं कहां रक्स बिन रहता नहीं ताऊस बन कोई भी हो
थैंक यू एंड जस्ट बिफोर यू रीड द ट्रांसलेशन पर्हैप्स यू कुड फर्स्ट एक्सप्लेन what a mountain cutter is, which appears about halfway through the poem in the English version, because there's a backstory, I think, isn't
there? Yes, that's right. Now, this mountain cutter, there is a legend. Shirin, her lover Farhad, broke his head when he could not win his beloved, even after he had fulfilled the difficult task of cutting a stream of milk through the mountain. So this was a condition. The true-hearted, that is the title. The true-hearted can settle no matter which land. A flower wants to bloom wherever its garden. If the gossip must be about current affairs, then anyone may be engaged in any crowd. What matter if it's a hair or a flower's vein, or which rope the devotee finds at the gallows? The same lack of reward awaits accomplished hands. In the end, the mountain cutter breaks his own head. Those who are ambitious do not depend on wine. Day or night, they stay drunk, whatever their longing. I await the art lover as I would some dear one. I spread eyes and heart in their path, whoever they are. Even today, Nasir's mark is on poetry. We search for him wherever poetry is shared. When do habits and desires ever change, Basil? Whichever in the forest, a peacock needs must dance.
Thank you. It is very clear the independence of the couplets in that particular poem, I think.
That's right.
They do have an aphoristic feel to them. There are certain images that Basil has used in that poem. The garden, the gallows, and the drinking imagery and the flower that I know are all part of the conventional figurative language of the ghazal. Could somebody talk about the symbols and images that are traditionally used in a ghazal? What other images crop up traditionally?
Well, traditionally, along with the garden, you would get the rose, the thorn, the nightingale. And of course in Indian ghazals you would get the bulbul or the Indian nightingale, clouds. You would get imagery that is particularly Sufi. So you would get wine, you would get the saki or the cup bearer, And this is why, really, a ghazal can be read at many levels. So you could read it as a secular love poem, for instance, but you could also read it as some spiritual teaching.
If you know the Sufi symbolism.
Yes, if you know, for instance, that the wine could actually symbolize spiritual inspiration, the cupbearer could be the guru who is leading you, helping you in your own journey, spiritual journey. The thorn could represent the many obstacles that that you have in the way. Perhaps on the way to your goal, to meeting your beloved, but that beloved could be God. But at the same time, because modern writers of ghazals are also stretching the language as much as possible, so new symbols are coming into the language.
Right, so you don't have to stick to that traditional stock.
Indeed, and also sometimes it's not just a case of love, secular love, and also divine love, but it could be thorns, for instance, on the way to political freedom. So that struggle could be a different struggle.
So alongside the English translations that Devjani and others have been making from Urdu and Persian and Bengali and a number of languages, a lot of Western poets, some quite big names, have written their own ghazals in English. And especially in the States, I think, for example, Robert Pinsky, W.S. Merwin, and Adrienne Rich. Mimi, could you perhaps talk us through how the ghazal found its way into America? And how do you take this form and make it sit within the parameters of English poetry?
Well, that is the challenge, isn't it? The ghazal has been around in European languages quite a while. Goethe wrote ghazals, or Lorca wrote ghazals, Judith Wright in Australia. But more recently, in the 1990s, a Kashmiri-born American poet, Ahar Shahid Ali, did a great deal of work in America, not only to introduce poets to the ghazal, but to introduce them to what he called the real ghazal. He published an anthology subtitled Real Ghazals in English, meaning those that adhere to the strict requirements of the form, as opposed to versions like Judith Wright's or Adrienne Rich's, in fact, versions of Ghalib. But it is hugely difficult. And to my mind, not just technically, I mean, there are the technical difficulties of not just the rhyme and refrain, but their aesthetic difficulties, in the same way that in Western poetry we recoil at the moment from fully audible rhyme. We want disguised rhyme. We want, in fact, all formal considerations to be disguised so that, you know, a big compliment you can give to someone is, oh, I didn't realise it was a sestina. Well, it would be a bit strange to write a ghazal and hope to elicit the compliment, oh, I didn't realise that was a ghazal.
That's not what you want.
It doesn't quite work. But there are the added difficulties of tone, the sort of a rhapsodic tone, the use of hyperbole, of praise, doesn't sit well with our penchant for irony, for understatement, for perhaps more timid or nuanced modes of address, especially for a woman writer. I mean, you can't, if you write without irony, in this idealised, adulatory way to some divine, beloved object, you sound slightly demented.
Or
just ridiculously sort of oriental.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that's the other risk of sort of self-orientalisation, if you like.
So it doesn't suit the sort of literary temperament in this country in this time?
Not really, although the paradox is that so many people who encounter the ghazal immediately fall in love with it and want to write one. The other thing that is difficult is not only the symbolic Sufi meanings, but, for example, the lack of imagery as imagery. for example, we mention a rose in a ghazal, we're not asking the reader to imagine exactly what the rose looks like or smells like in the way we would be in a Western poem. So the images are really emblematic.
It's there as an emblem.
Exactly.
And you've been quite modest in that, in British poetry today anyway, you are one of the foremost exponents of the ghazal. It would be great if we could end the discussion by hearing another of your own ghazals. I wonder if we could hear your ghazal After Harvest. Now, this is a translation or version again, and you said about it that the translation is free in some respects, strict in others. What did you mean by that?
Well, it is a translation or imitation, if you like. What I have kept to is the strict requirements of the form. So I have the rhyme, I have the refrain, the close couplets, the signature couplet, and in fact a meter, which obviously is not the same as the original Persian meter. In terms of the content, I have taken the conceit or idea in each of Hafez's original couplets, and in fact the refrain is the same as his, the word enough, and stayed faithful to that. But I have sometimes changed the emblem. You know, for example, I might have a vine instead of a cypress.
I see.
For the sake of the rhyme. Yeah. So those are the kind of liberties I've taken in this one. Ghazal After Hafez. However large earth's garden, mine's enough. One rose in the shade of a vine's enough. I don't want more wealth, I don't need more dross. The grape has its bloom, and it shines enough. Why ask for the moon? The moon's in your cup, a beggar, a tramp, for whom wine's enough. Look at the stream as it winds out of sight. One glance, one glimpse of a chime's enough. Like the sun in bazaars, streaming in shafts, any slant on the grand design's enough. When you're here, my love, what more could I want? Just mentioning love in a line's enough. Heaven can wait to have found, heaven knows, a bed and a roof so divine's enough. I've no grounds for complaint, as Hafez says. Isn't a ghazal that he signs enough?
That was Debjani Chatterjee, Bazir Kazmi and Mimi Kalvati in conversation with Julia Kopis. You can find out more about all these writers on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 77, which was recorded by Julia Kopis and produced by Kona McPhee. Grateful thanks are due to Carcanet Press and Redbeck Press for permissions for the poems included in this episode. Please visit our website for further information. Coming up in episode 78... the biographer Nicholas Murray speaks with George Miller about literary biography and his acclaimed Life of Huxley. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.